Why did Soto decide he'd rather be a Met? And don't tell me it's over the $5 million. I don't want to hear that.
Well,
And
wait a
we've
minute,
heard a couple
John.
things.
You're making like it was just $5 million.
Well,
It
that's
was
what it
way more than
was.
$5 million.
It
The
was.
Yankees offered a 16-year contract. The Mets offered a
Oh, well, I
15-year
mean, who,
contract.
when he's 42, that doesn't matter. I mean, how much is he worth at age 42?
You don't think it has anything to do with money?
Not the 5 million or the extra year. No, I don't think so. I mean, yeah, maybe ultimately he thinks that Cohn is going to spend more on the team and the team may improve because of that. I don't know. I mean, do you put any stock in a family member who was booted by a security guy?
Well, I mean, again, we're not exactly sure what happened there, but you can't let everybody in the clubhouse. Aaron Judge's family doesn't come in the clubhouse.
Well, I don't
I
think she
mean,
was in the clubhouse, but I mean, you see an elderly woman. I don't know how elderly. I actually don't know his mother, but you see a woman who's in her late middle age looking for Juan Soto. You got to figure, okay, this is Juan Soto's mother, or let me ask if she's Juan Soto. Not, I don't know. I mean, I wasn't there, but I did hear that this was an issue at some point. Soto's not going to talk about it. He's not going to make a thing about it, but it did feel like there was something he felt about the Mets and the family and all that. That's just my
well,
take, not yours.
things I've read is that Soto wanted to come back to the Yankees and his mother wanted him to go to the Mets. Everybody listens to their mom.
Soto has a sense of humor the way he is around the guys. What is it about him that seems to fit so naturally into the clubhouse?
For me, I didn't think he was going to be this quick, to be honest with you. I thought it was going to take a little bit longer, but he fit right in. I want to say, as soon as the position players report within a couple of days, you could see him laughing, making jokes, especially with some of the Latin players, and that was really good to see. And then when you watch him in the weight room, when you watch him in the cages, and guys are asking him, questioning how open he is to share his knowledge and some of the things that he does in the batter's box or when he's preparing, that just watching him go about it, he's like very humble, very open, and he's willing to share everything he's got. So that's been pretty impressive.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday, March the 9th, 2025. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com, no G, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on Instagram, Talking Mets, no G. And don't forget the newsletter, substack.com/@TalkingMetsNoG. And I want to thank the good folks on the Fansided Podcasting Network for supporting this show. Welcome to the Daylight Savings Time edition of the Talking Mets podcast. Hope you moved your clocks forward. I know I did in preparation for coming to you. Great guest in just a little bit. Just had a chance to talk to our good friend from the record, NorthJersey.com, Andrew Chedenick, a beat writer for the Mets. You guys know him on X. And we had a chance to actually, the minute that he signed on, we got the breaking news about Francisco Alvarez, broken hammock bone. He's out a couple of months. And not that I'm going to make the show all about that, but obviously that changes the intro a little bit. But you'll hear from Andrew in just a couple of minutes. We address that and we go through what really right now is, and I think daylight savings time, depending when it hits. But that's kind of like in that week or 10 days in between before or after is when you hit the dog days of spring training. And what I mean by that, and I talked about that a week ago, you're really tired of watching spring training games. I mean, it's nice to see David Peterson put up a nice outing. It's nice to see what Clay Holmes has done. Obviously, you love the Juan Soto performances offensively, but none of this counts. And you don't want these guys to leave their hits in spring training. It was interesting because I put a piece up over on the premium side over at Beyond the Mic about spring training records. And I found out some interesting things. And if you're a subscriber, you go out and check that a little bit. But the long and short of it is, it's hard to put any kind of stock in what you see in spring in terms of at-bats and batting average and results and record and things like that. But you can look at that on your own. That's not the point of the program today. But you're in that, where what I begin to call the doldrums. Now, you have a breaking news about Alvarez. And, you know, we'll get to that on the way out because I want to really stay on point and theme here. It's a thunderbolt. It's not the end of the world. It's certainly going to create some complexity. It creates some roster machinations. It creates, potentially some repercussions for Alvarez in terms of him getting up and running and how successful and how much development on the offensive side he has this year. But really, you know, as you head to this point of spring and you could see opening day right in front of you, there's daylight there. The one thing that has become clear, and it really resonated with me when I saw how Sean Reed Foley talked about staying with the Mets organization after he was designated, and he could have been picked up by anybody, and he was designated, he had no options left, and he talked about this being the organization he wanted to be with, and I'll bring this up to Andrew when he comes on as he covers the team and he's been in the locker room. A lot of times when you talk about culture and you talk about what a team is all about, there's so many narratives that come into play. It takes a life of its own. The media latches onto it. It almost becomes a marketing or a political campaign. It becomes indoctrination. It's like, okay, this is what I'll go to when this scenario comes up, because it's an if-then statement. It's an easy way to go about your craft. It's a way to, you know, fill content. It's a way to create thesis around your work. But the more you hear about the changes the Mets are making on the player development side, the people they're bringing in, the coaches, the way they treat these players' families, and really Juan Soto and what you heard, and you heard the clip coming in, and that's courtesy of a great podcast, the show. The New York Post puts out a great show with John Heyman and Joel Sherman, and they had Michael Kay on, and this whole Juan Soto thing is really a synopsis of the media not handling or seeing what's in front of them with the Mets and the changes, because the old narrative has been that the Mets don't know human interaction. The Mets don't know how to treat their players. They don't know how to treat their fans. They're tone deaf. They don't care about culture. They're reactionary to what the fans and the media say. And quite honestly, that's not been the case. I mean, what better way or more appropriate example was the whole Pete Alonso thing. I mean, Pete Alonso, and the more you hear about it, was prepared to go to Toronto. He didn't want to, and it would have been easy for the Mets just to cave into fan pressure and give him what he wants, but it still took some negotiation, and maybe that helped and certainly opened the eyes more so to Pete than to the Mets that how important and how loved he was here. I think it was always the case with the Mets, but And that's certainly the fans had a big part in that, but it didn't change the Mets' stance. They didn't all of a sudden hand out a 7-year contract. So, you know, what's interesting is that we're finding all these reasons, or the media is trying to find all these reasons why Soto picked the Mets, other than the fact that maybe this is a cool place to play. Maybe this is a place that has an interesting future. It's not just about the 25, 26, 40 guys on the roster. It's about those guys, and winning certainly is a big part of it. You could have the best family room. You could have the best ways to treat a player and all the aspects about his development on and off the field. But if you don't win, a place becomes a dreary place to play. So that's going to be where the players come into play. But everything that we talked about when that ball flew over the wall in Atlanta and the Mets made the playoffs, and in a lot of ways they shed nearly two decades of bad karma and a huge elephant on their back, you know, started to fade away. And there was the chance after they had a nice run in the postseason to leverage that. And so far they have. Now, I think the biggest key to all this, especially now with Alvarez being out, and you're going to have a bottom of the order that is going to be more focused on defense. And I think that's where they're going to go when they make the decision. I think they have to add someone to the 40-man. They have a couple of veterans like Chris Williams and Jackson Reitz and a kid in their system, Hayden Senger. Out of the three, Senger seems to be the best catch-and-throw guy. Hit okay at AAA. But that bottom of the order is going to maybe have Jose Siri, defense-first guy with pop, but defense-first. A Senger or a Torrens, both no more for their glove than their bat. And then let's see how it goes with the rest of the lineup. You know, you may have a Jeff McNeil down there or something along those lines. I don't know if they'll bat Jesse Winker or Marte that low, depending on where they are in the lineup. But you see where I'm going. You see where I'm going with all this. you know, there's a lot to be worked out there. But really, with Soto and Soto getting off to a good start, I think will dispel a lot of this idea that, okay, the Mets culture is overrated. Soto didn't really want to go there. He's there because, for whatever reason, somebody other than himself wants him there, his agent, his mom, his whatever. And right now, with the way the lineup is, with the way they have, you know, from an upside, look, Alvarez never really hit a tremendous amount. And I was still skeptical, even with the changes. I know he worked with JD Martinez. I was skeptical about what kind of hitter, with his lack of plate discipline, the approach, you know, what we could expect. Look, he's got a, you know, he's good at framing. The pitchers like throwing to him. I think he really, you know, his arm is okay, but I don't know if it's pop time. I have to look at those numbers a little bit closer. He's not nearly in the class of a Torrens. I know Torrens has a cannon, so he doesn't throw out as many runners as I think he could. But ultimately, he's there to be decent behind the plate and provide you with a bat. And he hasn't really provided you the bat, especially at the bottom of the lineup, where he can be a guy with pop who can really lengthen a lineup. So now that you don't have that, Soto getting off to a good start is critically important. I think it's important for that narrative that's going to creep in and create kind of that weaponized media tool to kind of drag back the old LOL Mets and create whatever you can create to stir things up. Because the Mets are boring right now. Yeah, they have the Montas injury, the Manaea injury, and then this Alvarez things create some, obviously, negative buzz. But they're boring because things are going smoothly. And Soto and Soto's start and how he plays when the bell rings, and specifically his impact on this lineup, is going to be a big thing. And historically, when guys come over either mid-season of a trade or sign a big contract, whether it be Beltran, Piazza, to a lesser degree, Cano, we all know the story of Bobby Bonilla, Lindor just a couple of years ago and how he struggled early mightily and how it took him a while, maybe even up till mid-season last year, to really get in with the fans and feel comfortable here. There's a New York baptism by fire. Now, Soto played in the Bronx, but Soto didn't play here. And Soto played in the Bronx when he was a free agent. He had Judge, so if he didn't perform, he could kind of be hidden. I mean, he would have been criticized. He went to San Diego where there were other big hitters. And let's face it, in that environment, in that low-key environment, you know, you can hide because you're out in the left coast. In Washington, he was the man when everybody left after the championship run and he was left naked. And he did, statistically, he was a fantasy baseball player. Nobody was going to criticize him when they were in, you know, retreat there in Washington. This is now his team. He's the hub. Maybe he's not a leader in the sense of Lindor. Maybe he's not the energetic guy that's going to lightning rod and rally the troops like Pete Alonso. But he is the hub of this offense. This is, like I said multiple times this offseason, a top 10 hitter all time in the same breath as Aaron and Mays and Ted Williams and things like that. This is no joke. How he starts off and how he performs is going to go a long way for first, then being able to navigate maybe a lighter bottom third of the order. And second, getting off to a good start and leveraging all these vibes, leveraging all this culture and family, and you know, the Mets are becoming a model franchise. No different than some of the things you heard when Mark Cuban took over Dallas and they became kind of this benchmark of how an NBA team should treat its players, and players wanted to play there. And they had success. And you know, maybe they weren't the 27 Yankees, but they won a championship and they had a nice run where they were consistently in the mix for winning it all. So it's interesting as we start off here, and we'll get to Andrew Trednick in a minute, how the idea that the Mets are turning it around and becoming boring because they're functional, because there is no gossip. This isn't the Bronx Zoo of the 70s and 80s. This isn't the worst team money can buy. This isn't just back in 2019 when Mickey Callaway and Brody Van Wagenen were running it, where they always seemed to be some kind of thing that wasn't baseball related to talk about. a lot of times things that were lionized that really shouldn't have been as big as they are. These guys just go about their business. And already the 2025 Mets have faced some significant thunderbolts. Two members, important members of their rotation, down. Their starting catcher, down. So the adversity has started. And you didn't think this was going to be a yellow brick road, right? We weren't just going to have a picnic from pitchers and catchers to when they're the last team standing. There's going to be a lot of peaks and valleys. There's going to be a lot of times where we come here on this show and we're going to feel like garbage about this team. We're going to be worried about this team. And we're going to be upset or frustrated about a bad stretch, a bad game, a bad performance. But right now, what they're showing you is that there's a certain calm. Even as you hear David Stearns talk coming in about the Alvarez injury, where they got this. And I think it's so important. And this is where, you know, you want to make the big bucks. You want to be the best, you know, the as of now, the highest paid player of all time. There's a certain amount of off-the-bat performance. Like, he could go out and have the same type of year he's always had, but have a miserable April. And I feel like that will follow him. Nobody will forget that. So it adds a little bit of pressure there. The last thing you want is it's second week of April. He hasn't really started hitting, and they're booing him at Citi Field. The bottom of the lineup is an albatross. I mean, they're going to catch the ball. They're going to throw the ball, but are they going to hit? And the team is struggling scoring despite the fact they imported a top 10 player in the history offensively in baseball. So it'll be interesting how that plays out. I think that Soto, to me, and I'll get into this with Andrew, I don't think he's taken aback by the moment. I don't think he's bothered by the media. I don't think anything phases him. I think he goes out there and just plays baseball. At least that's my first impression. We'll see what Andrew has to say about that. So let's take a quick break. When we come back, Andrew Tredenick of North Jersey, The Record, will be joining us. We'll talk about Alvarez, of course, the positional battles. Are there kids in camp that impress him? I know Brandon Sproat's a name that obviously comes up for everybody, but are there others? We know Brandon Sproat's out there. Juan Soto, this whole culture and family that Alex and Steve Cohen have created and that is now becoming a thing for the media to talk about. Is it a narrative? Is it real? The dog days of spring training are here. We're trying to spruce it up for everybody so that we give you something to chew on here at the Talking Mets podcast. Let's take a quick break. We'll be back with more right after this.
Kind of blow is that for you guys for the first month plus?
Yeah, it's a big blow. You know, when, you know, your starting catcher goes down.
Yeah.
But guys will step up. Guys will get opportunities. We feel good with what we have in-house. Pretty sure David and the group will be looking for outside as well, as he always does. But, yeah, you know, you hate to see it. You hate to see one of your players, anybody, especially in this case for Alvi. But, again, it's an opportunity for someone else to step up.
Carlos indicated that you guys might look outside for help. Do you have any thoughts?
We'll see.
That?
Yeah. I mean, I think we feel good about the guys we have in camp. Anytime you have a injury to a regular player, you're going to see what's out there. But we don't anticipate this being an extremely lengthy injury.
We're back, and joining me is back on the show. You guys know him on Twitter, Andrew Tredenick, at Andrew_Tred on X, beat reporter for The Record, NorthJersey.com, does a bunch of stuff, spent a little bit of time at spring training, and the Mets' new team store, and we got a lot to talk about. And Andrew, welcome to the program. So you and I are getting on here. We're ready to have a nice conversation. I got my notes in front of me. And the Mets decide to blow it up very rarely, and by the time this gets out, it won't be news, but you know, the Mets are going to be without Francisco Alvarez. They've had a few of those, what I call thunderbolts this spring.
Yeah.
Better, I guess, to get them out of the way early than late. So Francisco Alvarez is out, and that throws the roster conversation into a little bit of flux right now.
Yeah, I mean, you're getting live instant reaction here. This just broke, you know, about 10 minutes ago, so... You know, we're all still grappling with what happened. Obviously, it starts, you know, you feel pretty comfortable with Luis Torrens. Obviously, you know, he made, you know, real good strides last season. The pitchers love throwing to him. Really good defense. I think he threw out 15 of 17 runners last year. So His arm is maybe an upgrade over Alvarez and controlling the run game, but obviously Alvarez came into spring as a guy that, you know, you looked at as kind of one of the wild cards, and if he performed to the level, you know, of 2 years ago, you know, the lineup was a little bit more complete. You could feel a little bit more comfortable. So from here, I think maybe Hayden Sanger is the backup catcher. We'll see.
Good glove too.
I mean, he's a guy that, you know, you watch him in batting practice and, you know, he has the power. It's just a matter of, you know, hitting the pitching, which he hasn't necessarily done even at AAA. So, but, you know, another good defensive catcher. So, not going to get the offense from these guys, and it is a big loss to the lineup, you know, down in the bottom. So yeah, it's definitely the first kind of shock to the lineup here in spring. So 6 to 8 weeks, I guess you're looking at, you know, mid to late April, maybe early May, without your starting catcher. So add that to what you're dealing with the starting rotation, and, you know, hopefully you're not getting out to that same slow start as you did last year, but, you know, right, definitely some obstacles.
Hammock bone is not a good injury because it sucks your power out, you know, in a lot of ways. And you have to wonder what kind of lingering effect. I mean, the issue you have, I think, with this injury is that it pushes back Alvarez's offensive development. Now, spring training is spring training. I actually wrote about it over at our premium content. People get crazy about records, and I don't think these guys, and you were down there the first few weeks, the way the teams look at spring training, it's not about wins and losses. It's about getting your reps in. But Alvarez wasn't hitting the heck out of the ball. I know he has this new stance. JD Martinez, I guess, worked with him. This is going to be interesting how this plays out. The Mets can survive, and there's been arguments, and I think if you go back to September when he wasn't hitting, there was a legitimate argument about Torrens starting because of his arm. And he's not a great hitter, but he's passable. And quite honestly, if Alvarez is not the hitter that we think he is Torrens any worse? Now, I know long-term the upside, I get it, but this is a injury that, other than the backup situation and who's going to be the backup, the Mets have some options, like you said, Sanger and a couple of scrap heap guys, I think they can navigate similar to how they did last year.
Yeah, and it's something to monitor. Obviously, you know, with it being on his left hand, I know last year he had the thumb, and he told us in spring that, you know, it didn't really hamper him offensively, but, I mean, that hand is taking a beating behind the plate, you know, 160 pitches a game. Then you have to go and grip the bat. And obviously, it's the same situation here, and it's early in the season dealing with that. So I think you want him back fully healthy, you know, that hand being in good shape, because you don't want him coming back, rushing back, and still having the lingering effects of that injury either, you know, because of the position that he plays. You know, he's catching the ball more than any other player on the field. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, just that timeline and how they kind of proceed.
And you're going to need a roster move here because there's only two catchers on the 40-man. Chris Williams is in camp, non-roster invitee. Sanger in the organization, non-roster invitee. It's possible. I mean, depending if it's an eight-week scenario, do you just put him on the 60-day and do something like that? Because then you're going to lose somebody. So there's a lot of ripple effects still there to be worked out. You know, one of the things I had on the notes here, and it kind of jumps to the front, is the Mets have obviously Sproat and Tidwell and some interesting young pitching prospects. But offensively, we're still figuring out what they have. Jet Williams, Carson Bengay, Drew Gilbert, and the scrap heap. And I call them affectionately scrap heap guys. The guys like Jose Iglesias was a scrap heap guy a year ago are going to play a big way. And I had names like Chris Williams, Joey Meneses, Jerry Young, Jose Azokar playing a lot, you know, playing well, even though history. So this is an example, I think, of where the Mets 2025 and where Stearns has got to make his chops here. And he's done well in the past, in the year we've seen him, getting these guys that nobody really wants, that are willing to play in the minors, willing to take a split contract, willing to have no guarantees. And then when they're called upon, even if it's for 8 weeks, you get something out of them.
Yeah, and it was supposed to be Nick Madrigal. You know, he was supposed to be that guy, and then obviously he goes down. So who's going to be that guy? It's interesting. Last winter meetings, winter of 2024, that Jose Iglesias move kind of flew under the radar. You know, they add him to a minor league deal. No one, I was wondering, is this even worth a story? And then look, come to pass, is he's your most clutch hitter.
Great story.
Yeah,
great clubhouse guy.
So who, I don't know if you're going to get that type of production, obviously, because that was just unbelievable what he was able to do and the way he, galvanized the group. But who's going to be that next guy? And it's going to be interesting to kind of see, obviously the battle, the backup infield battle right now kind of looks like it's Brett Beatty, Luis Angel Acuña, but you worry about the reps, that these guys are going to get, behind the starters. So it'll be interesting to see kind of who steps up here. I know Jared Young's in camp, but, maybe a guy like that, we'll kind of see, here over the final 2 weeks and change here to see kind of how that unfolds. But Beatty's having an impressive, spring here. I know he's done that before, so, you take that with a grain of salt, but he's also excelled at AAA. What more is left for him to prove down below? I think he's kind of the front runner there for that final bench spot. And then you need a catcher. And then you have Marte and Winker who, we'll see what Marte's health is. So that could be another potential spot for one of these up and coming outfielders if he can't play. So
now Beatty to me, I mean, the metrics, if you look at any of the hard hit data, they're all positive in AAA. I still remember, Tim Healy in Newsday writing an article with Eric Chavez a couple of years ago, and Beatty basically admitting, look, the game is fast for me. I'm trying to learn how to focus. These are normal things for young players. These are not, oh my God, but they are concerning things. And I think that's really the interesting part. Can he, stay, like you said, stay fresh coming off the bench? I think most importantly is they don't have backup shortstop. Yeah. And can he give you the reps in a blowout on a day that Lindor with his back needs, DH time? When Lindor is not playing, if you DH him, he's the shortstop. Obviously you have McNeil. So I think that plays into it, because the thing about Iglesias, not to make this bigger than it is, because I think that's baseball. That's the cold, hard part of baseball. Iglesias is a character, but from a standpoint, the back of the baseball card, the baseball reference page, he's fungible. He's a guy that, very one-dimensional, doesn't play short as well anymore, only hits left-handed pitching. I think that you could agree it was a small sample size. But if Beatty doesn't make the club and if Donovan Walton makes it, then you kind of have more of a, why didn't you just bring Iglesias? Because the next opportunity is going to be if Walton falls on his face, which still puts Beatty in the same spot. Can you play short? Maybe this was more about Acuña than it was Beatty, quite honestly. But it is an interesting dilemma, because the flexibility right now, it's really about those two guys. And if those guys don't make the club, then what do you need the flexibility for? Just get the veteran at that point.
Yeah, it's one of the kind of the trickle-down effects of you sign Juan Soto, but you still have Marte under contract, and you didn't know if, Pete was going to be back. You bring in Jesse Winker, and now you look at a situation where you have a spot that needs to pretty much cover three spots in the infield. So it's going to be interesting to see, obviously Brett Beatty taking – shortstop reps during, hitting drills and whatnot. But, that's one thing, but game action is another. I did speak with him in spring training, and one thing that he did say was he thinks there's a bigger transition going from third base to second base because of just the angles, the way the ball
double
comes
play.
Off the bat. The double play footwork and stuff like that. You're also throwing from a different angle. So, maybe it's not as big, I think maybe the range is the biggest thing, obviously covering as much space as, no one's going to be Francisco Lindor at short. But, he did say that, it's more time with the ground ball coming to you. You have a little bit more time to hit first base. So, it didn't seem like he was overly kind of concerned when I spoke with him, but obviously, you need a guy that's comfortable there when the time comes, if Lindor is taking a DH day or something like that, which might not be the case early in the season. It'll be interesting to see.
That will be that will be interesting to see. I mean, the other name, and this is like pie in the sky, but fans throwing around, can Beatty be a poor man's or a version of what the Mets can get out of what the Phillies got out of Chase Utley? Now, remember, Chase Utley became a near Hall of Famer, but before that, he was a power hitting, bigger guy playing second. Forget the name and the comp. I never thought of that as he played. I thought when I first saw him taking reps at second and first, maybe sure I go, okay, the guy wants a big league career, not really a great hitter, but has pop, has potential. That's a way to keep himself on a field. Mm-hmm. Now I'm like, well, second base opens up a whole new world. He doesn't have to be a 30 home run guy at second base. He could hit 10, 12 home runs. He could hit 270 if he can be decent enough defensively. See, to me, I think the second base long range is interesting, not because I think McNeil is done. I think everybody's tough on McNeil. I think McNeil is not just throwaway like some people think.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
But it gives you, if McNeil is going to be Joey Wendell again and not, you know, Daniel Murphy in the, like he was in the second half, again, we're throwing all these names and comps around. I just, the way I could think about it, that's a viable option. And it's not like this is chopped liver. This is a former first round pick, albeit not on the Stearns, but let's not forget the guy's not chopped liver.
Yeah, and I think the biggest thing is just the mindset for him. You know, I spoke with him, and it was just, you know, so many kind of thoughts, you know, rattling around his head, you know, the last two seasons. He's trying to simplify things. You know, that's just the biggest thing. He had success early last season. A lot of people forget that he was, you know, through 16 games, it's like, okay, this guy might be this. And then kind of things went haywire. And then obviously we know what happened with Mark Vientos. So it's just a case where I think his glove has improved. I think we've seen that. He's made some really good plays at third during the spring. And now move him over across the diamond, kind of see how he can make that transition. But it's more the offense for him. And can he, you know, can he put it all together? So we'll see.
You were down early in spring. Obviously, hope springs eternal at that point. But as far as young players, taking away the Hayden Sengers, who are probably org fillers slash 4A, everyone's talking about Sproat. We've heard Tidwell. You know, I'm interested in this Alexander Canario. I know he wasn't there when you were there that they acquired from the Cubs. We've mentioned Beatty. Was there anybody? I mean, Sproat seems to be the one that everybody's talking about that could be this team's Noah Syndergaard late season or Steven Matz. Was there any other young players that caught your eye or that you heard Carlos Mendoza or Stearns talk about that, like, hey, keep an eye on him. Maybe not an option this year, but maybe part of a conversation that's more interesting down the road.
I'm really excited for Ryan Clifford, a guy that they acquired, you know, along with Drew Gilbert in the deal for Verlander. You know, he's a young guy. He came out of high school, so obviously he's still, I think, only 21 years old. But he hit 18 home runs in Double-A last year, so the power's there. The power's real. I was speaking with the Double-A manager, Reed Brignac. He said he's a guy that has power to all fields. You know, gap to gap guy, plays first base, but he's also kind of getting work in the corner outfield spots. So, you know, he could fill one of those potentially in the next maybe, you know, two years or so. The power is real from everything that, you know, Carlos Mendoza mentions. We saw him, you know, we'll see him again in the prospect game. So, you know, I think we're excited to see what he, you know, kind of that unheralded guy. He's still a young guy, and he's not really breaking down the door of the major league club. But I think, you know, if he can make some waves here this season, he's definitely someone to watch for that first base. Maybe they don't bring back Pete Alonso. Obviously, the corner outfield, you know, backup, something of that nature. So we'll see kind of where he fits. But he's not, unlike a lot of their prospects, he's not a middle infielder.
No.
So, yeah.
No. It's a critical year for the Mets' positional prospects, actually, in general. I mean, with so many injuries. The rotation. So that was going to be a big part of the conversation before we got sidetracked with Alvarez. And I understand I wasn't a huge fan of the Montas signing. I get it. I mean, that lat strain, not good news at all. I mean, you know, the Yankees are facing that with Luis Gil across town. We've seen it when your season gets kind of disrupted in spring. Carlos Carrasco, Senga, you're never right. Now, hopefully he gets back. I think it's more July than it is June, but whatever. You know, you're not – call me when he's throwing and he's healthy. That's what I say. Manaea is a little bit more short-term. Now, there was criticism about the rotation, and obviously I think a theme as you go and the Mets compete early on is going to be what starter becomes available. But I will say this. And again, it's spring training. And thank God for all these, you know, pitch FX things now. I'm sure you look at them like I do, because I'm not a talent evaluator. But you got to like what you see, obviously, out of Clay Holmes, and especially with all the FX data. You don't get as much FX data out of Peterson. David Peterson had a great start last night. Yeah. And they're not always impressive. But those two guys make me feel like, okay, that's not your ace, your typical ace. You still have Senga, who's going to be coddled a little bit. But with those three, and then let's see where 4 and 5 go. You know, McGill probably makes it, and then it's the battle between Griffin, Canning, and Blackburn. It's not – they can navigate that early on until Mania comes back. And I think they can navigate that while they figure out, do we have enough, and do we want to rip something apart like Sprout for a big-name pitcher?
Yeah, and I think the story early spring here is just Clay Holmes' development, and obviously coming in, it was, you know, he's a two-pitch guy, but we've seen kind of what that changeup is nasty. You know, he had pitchers looking or hitters looking, you know, completely dumbfounded, you know, in his first start. I know it was kind of the Astros, you know, 4A guys, but I think I'm curious to see beyond three starts, you know, three ups, what, you know, when he's going through a lineup the second time, kind of how he can, how he can attack that. But, you know, I've definitely been impressed, and you can tell that he came in spring training as arguably the most ready out of any of the pitchers, you know.
Very focused on making this work. Very focused. I think he has a little bit of an axe to grind. He lost his closer job across town, been there since mid-January. I mean, Andrew, the metrics, and I know Keith Hernandez threw the name, or was Gary Cohen threw the name on a broadcast, Logan Webb. I know we're throwing names, right? But when you look at the ground ball rate from the bullpen, even if it drops 5 points, 8 points, it's elite. It's top of the league.
Yeah.
That's a big deal. I mean, that's no joke.
Yeah. And, you know, we'll see how it translates. You know, guys are going to be seeing that sinker, you know, two times. You know, obviously that's the bread and butter pitch for him. Yep. So how can he kind of manipulate his repertoire to keep the guys off balance? And maybe the ground ball rate, you know, it'll always be there, but maybe it, like you mentioned, it does take a tick back, and he's getting maybe more swing and miss. And that'll be interesting for him. I think the biggest thing is, you know, he seems like he's pretty conditioned, but what does that second turn through the lineup look like? And how does his body hold up? You know, that's the biggest thing as he makes this transition. And how many innings will he be able to eat? I know he says he wants to throw 160 innings when we were at Amazing Day, but is that realistic? Right. You know, what is the 6-man rotation to kind of get him, you know, some additional rest? So that and the Senga thing, you know, him working back from injury, it's going to be interesting to see. You know, you're going to need another three guys beyond those top three as Mania and Montas, you know, progress through their injuries.
Absolutely. You have those two guys back. Sprout maybe gets in the mix. I think a 6-man rotation is inevitable. I don't see Blackburn out of the pen. I see Ken and Griffin out of the pen. I think that's how they signed him. I know Hefner likes him a lot. Where do you see the dark horse there in the fifth spot? I know Blackburn's health is iffy. I know the results haven't been great in spring. They don't seem to be concerned. He feels like that 6-inning, 3-run, fifth spot guy. I think he's a guy that probably get hit against some good offenses, probably do well against, you know, especially at home and maybe against some lesser offenses. But, you know, to me, that where do you see that? It's interesting because they don't talk much about where they see that going other than, well, let's just, you know, play this out for the rest of the spring.
Yeah. And I did do an opening day way too early. It seems roster predictions now with the Alvarez.
Gotta blow that thing up.
Yeah,
totally.
Exactly. But I had Blackburn and Canning in the rotation, McGill down in AAA to start the year. I think it's just a matter of just the roster construction. Those guys are on major league deals. You can't afford to, you know, send them down and they, you know, they go elsewhere, and they both, you know, sizable deals, I think around $4 million a piece. So by the time you maybe get through the six turn, you can bring McGill up if one of those guys struggles. And I think, like, you look at a guy like Max Kranick, I think he's an interesting case. You know, they're building him as a multi-inning guy, but he's a starter. So I think you look at him as, you know, a long relief option. Jose Budo, those guys that can eat multiple innings out of the bullpen, and kind of, you know, maybe piggyback if Blackburn or Canning have a short start. I think it's just the nature of the way the roster is constructed, though, that those guys are going to maybe get the first crack here.
Yeah, and you wonder at some point, I hate openers, but if you got a guy that could go three innings like Kranick, and you got you know, Blackburn, you know, maybe, you know, not that he's an opener, but you say, okay, I don't want him to go the second time through the lineup. In double headers or spots, you can see that maybe playing into it. It'll be interesting how that. I mean, to me, Max Kranich might be. You know, we talk about young players, and I want to get to the bullpen. Might be one of the biggest eye openers all spring. I mean, elite stuff. I'm not saying he's the next closer. A lot could happen. It's only spring. But quietly, as you know, he was on the postseason roster. Nobody talked about it because they didn't need him. Mm-hmm. They dumped him last year. He's always been someone that's been interesting, but he had that hamstring injury. I think he makes the club despite options because the bullpen gets crowded real quick. And you're going to – I mean, you already dumped shuttled Sean Reed Foley. He's going to be in the organization. Does Danny Young as a lefty, you know, what does that look like? You got Genesis Cabrera, a lefty, non-roster invitee. What's his opt-out? What's his deal? But Kranich, to me, it'd be very hard. I know options, like you pointed out with McGill, sometimes make it more beneficial for these guys to, unfortunately for them, sit at Syracuse and wait. But I think with Kranich, you really need to reward the performance and take him out of camp unless something changes.
Yeah, and I think you want that – early in the season with where the rotation is, I think you want those guys that can eat multiple innings. We're not really sure where Denell Nunez is going to be. That's a name that I'm curious to see kind of how his work goes here over the last few weeks. But you reward the strong performances last year, Reed Garrett, Jose Budo, those guys, I think you'll see. And then you have your three high leverage arms, Ryan Stanek, AJ Minter, another guy we'll see kind of how that unfolds with his coming off surgery, and Edwin Diaz. So, yeah, there's like maybe one spot or two spots to be had, and I think you want that kind of flexibility to go multiple innings, and Max Kranich gives you that, and he's been efficient so far in spring, so potentially reward that as well.
You're going to have guys. This is where it actually is exciting in one way. You could have a Nunez, a Brazenbaum in the minor leagues who clearly should be on a big league, I mean, healthy, of course, that should be on a big league roster. Maybe Danny Young gets sent, he stays in the organization. You have a lot of interesting guys. Now, there's the shuttling aspect. You're probably going to see guys who get used too much, like a Brazenbaum, who are just going to get sent down. And it's going to be horrible for them because they're like, I got a great record, I got a great metrics, but hey, I got options. They've played this really well in comparison to a couple of years ago when they had optionable relievers. But let's face it, they were 4A guys or they were scrappy guys that were lottery tickets. So you're going to have good arms specifically for the pen get sent down. And I think that's going to be difficult for those guys, but it makes it a lot easier for the Mets to navigate, especially in times when they're overusing the bullpen. And that's inevitable, as you all know.
Yeah, and you know, David Stearns has kind of made it clear that he likes that flexibility, guys with options, guys that can come in. And something that was interesting as I was writing that the opening day roster projection, I think only two or three names in the bullpen at the start of last opening day ended up with on the team by the end of the regular season. It was Adam Ottavino and Edwin Diaz.
You had
Johan Ramirez opened this season, obviously Jorge Lopez. It was a whole new unit, and we kind of found out over the course of the season who you can kind of count on, and guys, you know, rose up through the ranks. And if you have a guy like Huascar Brazenbaum down below, I think you can feel pretty good about what your bullpen depth is. It's almost kind of looking at like to be one of the strengths of this team, you know, coming in. So I like where the depth is at in the bullpen.
One of the, you know, obviously in the open, I was talking about it, and it's probably an overrated thing, but transitioning after a big contract to New York and specifically the Mets has always been a thing. I mean, guys have struggled. Piazza, Beltran, Cano, to a lesser degree, Bobby Bonilla, everybody knows about that. Francisco Lindor just a few years ago had a rough start to it. There's a lot of talk about Soto, whether he wanted to be here, whether his mom wanted to be, like, who cares? Like, at this point, the fact that we're talking about, this is why it's the dog days of spring training, Andrew. Yeah. Like, everybody's bored, media's bored, players, the hitters at least want to get going. The next 2 weeks, there's a lot of silliness that comes from it. Obviously, an injury like Alvarez makes it a little bit more palatable. But look, I mean, you were around the club. I know it was early. Soto, to me, is a guy from out looking at him just in press conferences, not observing him, doesn't really get fazed by a lot, very confident. I'm not sure he's ever, you know, I certainly don't think he was ever attached to anything in the Bronx, just because he knew he was only there a year. I'm not sure he was ever attached to San Diego. I think the last 2 or 3 years has been kind of like a mercenary part of his career, and that's okay. He's not the first player to do that. I think he's here, and he seems to be enjoying it. I don't think he's going to be a problem with the media. I think he doesn't get phased by – at least he doesn't look right now. Now, if he starts out hitting .150 the first 2 weeks of the season, that's going to be interesting.
Yeah.
But I just don't see this as a guy, not just because he was in the Bronx last year, that is going to have a problem. He might be one of the first guys in a long time to come here and not have that early valley, because every big player's had it for the most part. And it will be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, it's interesting, like, through his first press conference, how he was still kind of coming to terms with the idea that this could be his home for 15 years after, you know, moving through three teams the last 3 years, finally being able to kind of set down his roots. And something that's also stood out was just the prevalence of Latin American players on the team, and some Dominican players. Starling Marte, he's, you know, seemed to build a pretty strong relationship with Jose Siri, you know, guys speaking his language in the clubhouse, you know, similar tastes in music. I don't know how much that was present with the Yankees. So, you know, I think he's starting to get comfortable. You know, we've seen, you know, obviously 3-for-3 last night, you know, obviously the hitting's going to be there. You know, what does a struggle for Juan Soto look like early in the season?
Maybe a drop fly ball. Yeah, you know, he did flop around. Look, he did flop around Citi Field last July. We saw that. And I thought about that when I was watching that. But you mentioned Siri. It's interesting. That's a guy now with Alvarez out at the bottom of the lineup, a feast or famine guy that, you know, unless Taylor gets more time, it's possible.
Yeah.
He becomes a little bit more important. Interesting guy. Hot dog. I'm not crazy about it, but it is what it is with him.
Yeah.
He's a guy that's going to have 200, but have 35 home runs and really elite defense. So it is interesting with him and Soto after the whole home run trot thing last year, you know, having them all together there in the lineup.
Yeah. I spoke with Jeremy Barnes on Siri in particular. He said, this is a guy that doesn't need to do too much. If he's batting in the ninth spot, just get on base, use your speed, you know, put the ball in play. And then the lineup flips over to Lindor. Then you have a guy with speed on the base pads. You know, obviously one of the quickest players in the major leagues. And we've kind of seen that, you know, in the outfield. So, the key is going to be the bottom of the lineup now with Alvarez out. You know, can Jeff McNeil be more of that, the second half player? Can Siri up the average, maybe get on base a little bit more? I think, you know, you look at the bottom of the lineup, you know, some guys with some question marks, but, you know, if one or two of them could put it together, this lineup looks completely different, especially with Francisco Alvarez out.
Yeah, I mean, I think 5 runs a game is not too much to ask. I think especially with some of the deficits in starting pitching is necessary. I think what will be interesting about this lineup is even in 2022 when they had a good lineup, but at times last year they had a good lineup, they had these brownouts and left-handed pitching they struggled against. That was a whole nother thing. Even though they had good numbers individually, it seemed like lefties bothered them, and the team stats bear that out. It will be interesting. Can they navigate where they're not, you know, brownouts for three of the 9 innings because you have this Siri, McNeil, whoever the catcher is at that point? I think they can. And I think Soto, I mean, you saw it with the Yankees, just Soto being in that lineup change the Yankees didn't have it, especially even in the middle of the summer. And yeah, I know they struggled, but, you know, the Mets played them kind of when they had all those injuries and they had Austin Wells and JD Davis. You still had those two guys. And I know that Judge plays into that and the Mets don't have Judge, but the guy just changes the dynamic completely. I think that that's enough to overcome maybe, you know, a couple of months without Alvarez. And we're not even sure Alvarez is the hitter that we think he is at this point. So,
yeah, you feel really, I think you feel really strong about the top five, you know, six in this lineup. The biggest thing, you know, for me is kind of, can Mark Vientos replicate what he did down the stretch last season? He didn't really have any slumps last year. You know, he might go through 2-3 games where he was 0-for-3, but then he kind of bounced back and, you know, he was back, you know, delivering home runs, clutch hits and stuff of that nature. I think he is another key to this lineup. Over a full 162, we haven't seen it from him yet. I think you know what you're getting from, obviously, Francisco Lindor, Juan Soto. Can Pete have maybe a little bit more representative season from 3 years ago, so maybe somewhere in between 3 years ago and last season. And Brandon Nimmo, can he up his average and get on base to the clip that we know he's capable of? You know, he'll be key. And can he be durable again? That's another big thing for him. So I think you feel pretty good about where that top of that lineup is, because all those guys are capable of doing various different things, whether it's getting on base, stealing bases, contact, power. You have a good blend of a lot of different things there at the top.
A couple of things before we wrap up. First, you know, the whole, you know, Mets culture and what Steve and Alex Cohen have done has been a big theme, but mainly because of Soto. But even when you hear a Sean Reed Foley, and maybe he had no options, nobody wanted him, but I mean, the odds of him, if he's healthy, breaking into this bullpen are not great. I mean, he should go somewhere else than to come here, realize the value. I know they're doing a lot of things from a player development standpoint. I know that there's a lot of family things going on. You're around the club. You were around the club last year. Sometimes these things take a life of their own and become a narrative and become bigger than they are, but you're hearing so much of it, and it's such a huge advantage, especially for an organization that has been the antithesis of that, and it's hurt them, how they treat players and how they are perceived. The worm has really turned. So is there a lot, you know, is this real, or are we making this out to be the dog days of spring training narrative story just to fill some time?
No, I think you look at this, the ownership group, the front office, you look at, you know, Steve Cohen and Alex, their presence with the team. You know, Steve is around the team, you know, at Citi Field. You see him maybe 2 days a week. You see Alex maybe 4 or 5 times a week. You know, they're around and they're present and they're sitting in the front row at playoff games, you know, celebrating with the guys in the clubhouse. They really seem to enjoy his presence. And I think they appreciate, you know, the ownership going out of their way and, you know, spending the money to put a contender on the field year after year, making that commitment that we're not just going to kind of, you know, skate by and rest on our laurels or, you know, not make a commitment and go out and spend. They're doing what it takes to build a consistent winner. And I think the players appreciate that maybe more than anything. So I think it is a real thing. You know, every year you go into Citi Field and something's a little bit different. You know, it was like the lights last year, just putting on a show for the fans, putting on a good product. You know, a lot of the players have talked about the family room and, you know, what they do for their kids and how there's a space where their wives can go, you know, take care of the kids. You know, the home plate club was overhauled last year. So, you know, you just see the commitment from the ownership group to kind of, you know, not only for the players, but for the fans to put out a good product, give them a reason to kind of go to the ballpark. So I think, you know, you definitely like what you've seen from them. But the biggest thing is taking it one step forward and getting to the World Series and potentially winning a World Series, because that's the one promise that Steve hasn't really been able to keep so far. And I know it's a difficult task, but
you can't buy it. Can't buy it for sure.
Exactly.
As we wrap up, you had a piece, and everybody's been curious about it, but the Mets House NYC. And I think it ties a little bit into some of the conversation that has been going about regarding attendance and fan engagement. Look, I remember, you know, growing up a Mets fan, and then 1996 happens, and how that Yankees team captured the city and captured a whole generation of young fans. To this day, they're in their 30s and 40s, those fans, and their kids are going to be Yankees fans. And it just, it builds and it grows, and George Steinbrenner leveraged that. He was within the rules of the game, getting, I think it was Adidas, doing a ton of advertising and bringing in revenue that other teams could not. Now, things have changed, and they may change in a couple of years with a new CBA. But when I see the Mets coming up with a pop-up shop and them talk about how to engage with fans outside of the ballpark, ultimately, if you're really going to pack that house like the Yankees, like the Knicks, it's not going to be with 45,000 hardcores like me, you know, like I'm not, or like the fans that listen to this show. The fans that listen to this show are the hardcores, but they're not 45,000 strong. You need those people that, oh, I'm going to go to a couple of games here. The Mets are a cool place. Oh, that's a really cool pop-up shop. I like that Mets jersey. My daughter likes that jersey. My son likes that jersey. Oh, my nephew really likes, you know, Vientos, whatever. That's how you build a brand, and that's how you pack the house. And I think they're starting to move in that direction. Talk about your experience at this event and this store, and It's a pop-up shop, which I guess it's seasonal, but what do you got for us? Do you agree with that summation I just put together regarding the greater strategy here that the Mets are trying to employ?
Yeah, I think you look at it, and I think it's going to be open for 3 months with the potential to extend it. But you had fans, you know, it was pretty cold on Friday, and there was fans there from 6 a.m. The line was around the block. I think it was just a cool way to kind of drum up interest, you know, early in the season. You know, you've seen a lot of the Mets do a lot of things kind of for the fans, like waiving service fees for tickets and stuff of that nature, trying to drum up interest that way. And I think they put out a good product. You see a lot of fans just out and about wearing Mets hats. I think, you know, the culture feels like it's starting to change even among the fans, maybe a little bit more optimism than there's been in the past, just where the team is, the investment. So yeah, I think it was a kind of cool idea. You know, obviously it's in a great location, Union Square, right in the hub, you know, transition hub there in downtown. So, you know, it was a cool spot, jerseys, you know, memorabilia, stuff like that. I think it was kind of a unique idea to kind of spark a little bit extra interest going into baseball season. And it was kind of interesting talking to Steve, obviously, about the attendance there in spring training, how he was kind of peeved a little bit about where they finished. I think it was around 17th in MLB in attendance.
Yep.
And he's hopeful that, you know, the attendance kind of trails production. So, you know, with the run last year, I think they're a little bit more optimistic about, you know, what the attendance will be, you know, with some optimism coming off last season. I think season tickets are ahead of where they were at this point last year. So I think they're optimistic, and it's about creating that next generation of fans with maybe some young players. Juan Soto is going to be here a long time. So, you know, I think fans have to feel pretty comfortable about, you know, the direction of the club.
So what's next at NorthJersey.com? You have social over there. Obviously, you're an online product. You cover the team. Fans love following you on Twitter. As soon as I announced, oh, Andrew's coming on, I get, oh, I can't wait to see Andrew. They're more excited about you than me. You know, we got to get you on more. So what do you got coming up? You do great work. Obviously, I follow you, and you've been on before. So give the fans an idea as we head into opening day in just a couple of weeks. What can we expect from you and the North Jersey team over there?
Yeah, that's right. Got one more week at home, and then I head back to spring training for the last week. So I'm excited for the prospect game and seeing some of those young kids. And obviously a lot of the names that maybe people aren't familiar with and them on the field. So, yeah, just, you know, I'll be doing some projections, looking at some of the key performances so far, maybe guys, unheralded guys, and who we might expect to be on the roster. So yeah, I'll be back down last week of spring training. I'll be in Houston on opening day. So just make sure to stay tuned, NorthJersey.com, and follow me on Twitter at Andrew_Tread for all my Mets coverage. And I'm excited for what the 2025 season holds. You know, it should be another exciting one. So
I think your chocolate lab is excited too, as we're playing. So for those who are listening, as I'm talking to Andrew, he's got a new puppy. And she couldn't help but get involved. Like, as soon as I said, you know, Mets Store NYC, I see a head pop up. As soon as I see, yeah. As soon as I hear about Alvarez, head pop up. So maybe she can give us some insight next time. But you've been great. I've kept you long, and you were able to make it on daylight savings time, which I made sure as I set my alarm clock. I'm like, I gotta make sure it's safe. So you be well. I'm looking forward to catching up with you during the season. And thanks so much, Andrew.
Appreciate it, Mike. Thanks.
And that's Andrew Tredenick. Interesting conversation, obviously, right before we go on the air, news breaks. So you heard me tease that in the opening. All right, let's take a quick break and wrap up. You're listening to the Talking Mets podcast. We'll be back with more right after this. All right, we're back. Final thoughts. I want to thank Andrew Tredenick for his time here on a Sunday. Had a rare time here on the Talking Mets podcast where we actually break, you know, we don't break news, but we're there when the news is broken. So real quick, as we wrap up, so the catching situation, I see already on X all sorts of names thrown out there. Thomas Nito, who might be not making the roster in Detroit, James McCann, I mean, I see all sorts of names. Look, take a step back. He's not out for the year, Alvarez. The Mets don't have room on the 40-man roster. I would be curious, depending on the length of the injury, can they put him on the 60-day? He's out. You know, they have to really look at this. Is he going to be out 60 days? That's, you know, something they have to think about, or they're going to have to remove somebody from the roster. I think you have a couple of guys, a couple of scrap heap guys that this is where, not to, you know, do a sales pitch to you guys, this is where the trash and treasure, those little segments we do, or those little pieces of the premium content over at the website come in handy. Chris Williams is in camp. Jackson Reitz, non-roster invitee, is there. Chris Williams has gotten a little bit more time. He's a guy that has some flexibility, can play first base in the outfield. Same thing with Jackson Reitz, who's more of a catch-and-throw guy. Neither of these guys, I mean, whether they have power on base, they all seem to follow a profile of what an analytics-driven team like the Mets are trying to accomplish, or as they try to bring guys in for depth, what they want. They want guys with on base with power on the offensive side. And when the case is Stearns, these guys can catch the ball a little bit. They have good pop times. They can throw guys out. In the case of Reitz, you know, good arm strength, good leadership. In the case of Williams, good arm as well. Some power there. I think ultimately Torrens is going to have a chance to establish himself there and be the everyday catcher early on. His hitting was outstanding early on when he came up, made the big play in London. We know what he could do defensively, how strong his arm is. And I think the most logical thing is you have this kid down in AAA, hit 252 in Syracuse, a little bit of pop, good pop times. It sounds like, just looking from the scouting report, his pop times make up for maybe the fact that he doesn't have the strongest arm, but he's got good mechanics and he should be able to keep the running game honest in this current, can't throw more than two pickoffs. That's a big thing. He won't embarrass himself offensively. You're going to have to add him to the roster. He's homegrown. Yeah, he's in his late 20s, so that means he's not much of a prospect. But this is where depth comes into play. So it will be interesting how the Mets decide on this. I feel like it'll be, because we haven't heard a lot about Reitz this spring. But we've seen Williams play a little bit, and we've seen Singer play a little bit. So anyway, that's where I think this goes. Hope you enjoyed this segment with Andrew Tredenick. A lot of things there for us to chew on as we enter the dog days of spring training. It's the 9th of March, opening day just a couple of weeks away, and the journey, which has begun with some significant thunderbolts already, that's going to create some challenges for the Mets. The journey really begins in a couple of weeks, so stay tuned. But we'll be talking about it, writing about it over at Beyond the Mic. You know, if you're not a member, love for you to become a member there at Substack, substack.com/@talkingMetsNoG. And I'm sure we'll get into this catching situation and other stuff as the week goes on. All right, that's it. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in to the latest edition of the Talking Mets Podcast. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X @TalkingMetsNoG and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva @TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Noji, Mike Silva @TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You get me on Instagram, TalkingMetsNoG. And don't forget the newsletter, Substack.com/@TalkingMetsNoG. And I want to thank the good folks on the Fanside Podcasting Network for supporting this show. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. We'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast next week. Till then, take care, everybody. Meet the Mets. Head for the